This is probably one of the largest, most complex projects in the world today.
One of the biggest projects in the world.
In the world, right here in Alaska.
Understanding the complex Alaska LNG project. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the toll of the drug spice on Anchorage's homeless residents.
Today I came down, I didn't see nobody laying down, so I was happy for that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The U.S. Bureau of Land Management has approved a drilling permit that it says will open the way for the first oil and gas production from federal land in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The permit is for the Greater Moose's Tooth 1 project being pursued by ConocoPhillips, Alaska. In a release, BLM Director Neil Korns said it was a collaborative effort to ensure responsible development in the Arctic Reserve that will provide a new source of oil for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. A regional mitigation strategy also is being developed. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski welcomed the news, but noted the tortured path, she says, Alaskans have been forced to navigate to develop on federal lands in Alaska. As we speak, state lawmakers are packing their bags and preparing to head to Juneau for their third special session of the year. This session is focused on one thing: the Alaska LNG project. That's the giant pipeline the state hopes to build, along with ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, to bring natural gas from the North Slope. But if you're like a lot of Alaskans, you might be a little fuzzy on the details. So here's APRN's energy reporter Rachel Waldholz to break it down in the first of two stories.
I wanted to find out what Alaskans know about this project. So I parked myself outside the Fred Meyer on Northern Lights Boulevard in Anchorage.
Something they've been talking about for 30 years. It's just one of those pipe dreams.
Literally.
Yeah, literally.
If I say liquefied natural gas, do you know what that is?
No. Liquefied natural gas?
I'm thinking it's liquefied for easier transport. It's easier to transport a quantity of liquid versus the same quantity of gas.
That is exactly it. That is exactly it. And here's the short version. The Alaska LNG project will bring natural gas from the North Slope down to Nikiski on the Kenai Peninsula for export to buyers in Asia. In order to load the gas onto the ships that will carry it across the Pacific, it has to be liquefied. And it's a huge project. The estimated price tag is $45 to $65 billion.
Yeah, this is way bigger than TAPS. This is probably one of the largest, most complex projects in the world today.
One of the biggest projects in the world.
In the world, right here in Alaska.
Lydia Johnson works for ExxonMobil. She's the project's technical manager. And she's standing at a map showing the proposed route of the pipeline. The key point, if you remember just one thing, is that the Alaska LNG project is not just a pipeline. It actually has three big pieces. First, there's a gas treatment plant on the North Slope to prepare the gas for the pipeline. Then there's the pipeline itself running some 800 miles down to Cook Inlet. And then there's the giant liquefaction plant in Nikiski. Johnson says each one of the components is a mega project in its own right.
You put them all together, that's a giga project. That's our term.
That's right, a giga project. And one that could bring in more than $2 billion a year in state revenue. So let's walk through this giga project.
So if I'm a natural gas molecule, natural gas is found below ground. So we're looking at the fields of Point Thompson and Prudhoe Bay.
And the gas at Prudhoe Bay has been tempting pipeline builders for decades. For some 40 years, the state has fielded different proposals, most recently to connect the North Slope to the lower 48. The shale gas revolution put an end to that plan. Suddenly, nobody needs more gas down south. That's why this plan would ship the gas to Asia. But before it can go anywhere, it has to be treated. The project calls for a gas treatment plant on the North Slope to strip out impurities like carbon dioxide.
This will be the largest gas treatment facility in the Arctic ever. Huge project.
from that huge project into the next one. From the gas treatment facility, the gas would go into a pipeline rivaling the Trans-Alaska pipeline in length. There are some key differences. The existing pipeline carries crude oil.
So think of it as syrup. So syrup going through a pipeline needs to be very hot.
And that, by the way, is why much of the Trans-Alaska pipeline is above ground. You don't want to build a hot pipeline in permafrost.
Now you think of natural gas. What that means is it's very cold. It comes out of the ground naturally very cold, and it's in a gas form. And the way that you have to push gas is it needs pressure.
So the gas line would be buried. It would run alongside the Trans-Alaska pipeline until just north of Fairbanks. From there, it would break off and head south to Cook Inlet. Along the way, the line would need 8 compressor stations to provide pressure and move the gas along. There are also plans for 5 offtake points. The idea is to deliver natural gas to Alaska communities along the route with the hope that it would lower local energy costs. The line would cross under Cook Inlet, perhaps near Tyonek, and end at a brand new liquefaction facility at Nikiski. That is where the magic happens, and it's expensive magic. Roughly half the cost of this $45 to $65 billion project is just the liquefaction plant. And the point of liquefaction is to shrink the gas to a manageable size. When the gas is chilled and becomes a liquid, it becomes 600 times smaller.
But if you took natural gas and without liquefying it, you would need huge ships, and it would be basically, you know, a floating bomb, which you don't want. So if we can liquefy it, compress it, it makes a much safer way to travel and a much more economical way to travel.
Those ships then become essentially floating pipelines, carrying the gas to markets around the world. But here's the catch. Liquefying natural gas requires cooling it to negative 260 degrees Fahrenheit. There are only so many places on Earth where that can be done. As it happens, one of those places is already in Nikiski, ConocoPhillips' Kenai LNG plant. And that's where we'll go tomorrow, when we get to use the word cryogenic in a non-sci-fi context. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
Hospitalizations from spice usage are peaking again. The Anchorage Fire Department has transported about 20 people per day for the past week. Most calls come from the area between 3rd and Carluck and Town Square Park. People say they know the drug is dangerous, but some of them choose to keep using it anyway. KSKA's Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman found out some of the reasons why.
Anna Lincoln sits at a table at Bean's Cafe, working on a crossword puzzle and finishing her lunch. From her perspective, the day has started pretty well.
Today I came down, I didn't see nobody laying down, so I was happy for that.
Lincoln is referencing people being knocked out from spice, a street drug made from an ever-changing mixture of chemicals and dried plants. It's been the cause of more than 450 emergency calls in the past 3 months. Lincoln says people are aware of the risks, but they still use it.
Because it's cheap and, you know, it's easy to get. It's very available.
Bean staff say a spice stick, which is like a joint, can go for about $10, but people share the costs, so it's cheap. Lincoln says she used it once, but by accident. She thought she was buying real marijuana.
I bought one for $5 and I smoked it out there. I started shaking. No more after that. One puff, that was it. I smashed it on the ground and I looked for that person that sold it to me. I scolded him right away.
Archie Swan, another client at Beans, says he was curious about spice, so he tried it once with his friend.
I started freaking out, sitting there, and I looked at all the lights straight across the street. And when I look at the lights, I feel like all that light was looking at me as eyes. It looked like there were eyes looking at me, and I freaked out. I thought that was the end of it for me, but then 10 minutes later, all that feeling I had was gone.
Swan says he'll never try it again, but others are less concerned about the risks. One man, who declined to be taped, says he's been hospitalized twice with seizures from smoking the drug, and his fiancée died because she was using it and drinking. He smokes it anyway because it's easier to get than marijuana, and he wants a high, even though the high is very different from pot. Bean's executive director, Lisa Souter, whose staff has responded to many of the emergencies, says the effects of the drug vary widely depending on the batch.
Some people smoke it and are just fine. Other people become catatonic. Some people become violent. And I think that really shows the wide variation in what the drug may possess. It's not a naturally occurring substance. This is not marijuana. This is not cocaine. This is a very different deal.
Sutter says she thinks the mayor's proposal to make selling spice a crime could make a difference.
It's not even a misdemeanor charge to be selling this substance. So if you're a drug dealer, what drug are you going to sell? You're going to sell the one that has the least risk for you.
But she says the law needs to be coupled with more treatment options. Sutter says spice started appearing near beans about a year and a half ago. Its usage has increased as it becomes more easily available on the street. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, launching weather balloons for the National Weather Service on a remote island in the Bering Sea.
I feel privileged to be doing this because, you know, I'd always wanted to work for the Weather Service, and now I am working for the Weather Service, and I couldn't be happier.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
A former FBI agent says Fairbanks police violated fundamental investigative protocol following the 1997 murder of John Hartman. Greg McCrary testified on behalf of the men known as the Fairbanks Four, convicted of the Hartman killing, who are seeking exoneration. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Testifying during an ongoing evidentiary hearing, criminal investigation and interview expert Greg McCrary faulted former Fairbanks police detective Aaron Ring for narrowing the focus of the John Hartman murder investigation after Eugene Vent was picked up downtown during the early morning hours after Hartman was found severely beaten on a nearby street.
As a matter of fact, Detective Ring testified that he had no evidence to suggest that Mr. Vent or the others were involved at all when he began this very guilt-presumptive, accusatorial interrogation of these young men.
The state objected to inclusion of McCrary's testimony, characterizing it as opinion.
Would you agree that your field's not an exact science?
Assistant Attorney General Ali Rahoy challenged McCrary's assessment of the investigation, saying police talked to more than just Vent and the other Fairbanks Four.
Isn't it true that the Fairbanks Police Department conducted approximately 200 interviews in the course of their investigation?
I don't know how many they conducted overall.
Okay, and that's because you only partially reviewed their investigative report.
Correct.
McCrary contended the additional interviews were solely to build a case against the Fairbanks Four, not to look for other suspects. McCrary is also critical of initial police questioning of Vent and Freeze when they were drunk and sleep-deprived, as well as use of false evidence to persuade confessions from the two, who said they could not remember what happened around the time Hartman was beaten on a downtown street. McCrary referenced an interview transcript in which Detective Ring lies to Vent that police have conclusive evidence tying him to the crime scene.
He says your shoe print is right in that blood.
McCrary says so-called guilt-presumptive investigations have proven to yield false confessions, characterized by admissions like those made by another Fairbanks Four member, George Freeze.
All he did was feed back the information he was fed. I didn't see anything that would independently corroborate his involvement.
Also discussed at yesterday's hearing is the potential testimony of a man whose previously alleged involvement in the Hartman attack. The Fairbanks Daily Newsminer reports that attorneys argued over whether Jason Wallace, a former Fairbanks man serving life for an unrelated murder, should be granted immunity against prosecution for the Hartman attack if he testifies. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
This year was a near-record fire season for Alaska and the entire western U.S. In the lower 48, aircraft fighting fires were repeatedly grounded when gawkers flying their own drones were spotted in the skies. They're a danger when they intrude on the airspace, but unmanned aircraft can also be an asset in firefighting. APRN's Liz Ruskin has more.
In Idaho last week, Lockheed Martin, the Interior Department, and the Forest Service demonstrated how an unmanned K-MAX helicopter might be used in firefighting. They programmed it to hit certain GPS coordinates, and Lockheed supplied video showing the chopper essentially flying itself over a simulated fire. It scooped buckets of water from a lake and released them over the landscape to create a wet line, then delivered multiple loads of cargo and came back to base. The K-MAX is a full-size chopper. Some versions are flown by an onboard pilot. John McMillan of Lockheed Martin says the ability of the K-MAX to fly a pre-programmed route allows it to be very precise and eliminates human variables.
Whenever you do line building, you want to be able to hit a spot and be able to create a continuous line of water to create that barrier.
Lockheed says someday fire crews might climb into an unmanned K-MAX for emergency evacuation. The Interior Department hopes to test the K-MAX over a prescribed burn and then maybe try them in a real-life fire as soon as next summer. Bill Gabbert fought fires for both the Forest Service and the National Park Service for more than 30 years and says the utility of the $10 million K-MAX is promising but still uncertain.
Well, so far they haven't used it on an actual fire, so it certainly is not a game changer yet. And maybe in a decade or two, if they advance the technology a great deal and work out some issues that need to be resolved, such as safety of firefighters on the ground, it could be a useful tool in the toolbox.
Gabbert publishes a website called Fire Aviation. He says the K-MAX could be flown by a pilot during the day and then fly autonomously once the sun goes down because most firefighting aircraft can't work in the dark.
The fixed-wing air tankers do not drop water at night, so adding some water-dropping helicopters at night would be very helpful. The fires move more slowly at night. So being able to attack them from the air while they're moving slowly could be very helpful.
Nighttime is when small unmanned airplanes took to the skies over the Funny River Fire, a blaze that burned through 200,000 acres of the Kenai Peninsula in 2014.
So at 11 p.m., we would launch these unmanned aircraft, and we would fly all night.
That's Marty Rogers. He's director of the Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration at UAF. Rogers also led the team that launched 40-pound Scan Eagles over the Funny River Fire to gather intelligence.
At 0700, when the new firefighter ship came on board, they could actually then go directly to those hotspots, which were GPS referenced, and we provided infrared imagery of those locations, those fires.
Rogers says the technology has proved its worth in firefighting. But when the Sockeye fire raged in the Susitna Valley this summer, the drones weren't deployed. Rogers says it points to one of the biggest limitations on using the technology in firefighting. With so many agencies involved, managing what's in the sky over a fire is incredibly complex.
The use of unmanned aircraft right now as it relates to wildfire has much more to do with there being methodologies which are well understood, and between the agencies, processes between the agencies to allow for the safe integration of the unmanned aircraft into the airspace.
Lack of that kind of planning apparently doomed an earlier Forest Service attempt to deploy drones. The agency spent $100,000 in 2007 to buy two Skyseer aircraft. The equipment sat unused for at least 7 years. The Forest Service said it had trouble getting FAA permission to fly them. Rogers says the K-MAX helicopter might be most useful in delivering supplies to firefighters. He says he's also got his eye on an unmanned amphibious water bomber that a Spanish company is testing in Iceland. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Linfield College in Oregon offers degrees in the arts, sciences, and professional programs, and a rich campus life with athletics, music, study abroad, and more. Linfield College representatives are visiting area high schools in Anchorage, Kenai, and Fairbanks the week of October 20th. Learn more at linfield.edu. This message sponsored by Linfield College.
Twice a day, balloons are released from hundreds of locations around the world at the same time. Before they burst in the upper atmosphere, they help weather forecasters pinpoint what's going on overhead. KUCB's John Ryan tagged along with a forecaster on St. Paul Island as he fought a windstorm to launch his balloon into the sky.
William Wells lives and works at what may be the nation's most remote weather station. It's 300 miles off the west coast of Alaska in the Bering Sea. Even on St. Paul Island, his station is remote. It's off by itself, a few miles away from the village of 400 people who call St. Paul home. Each afternoon, he walks from his office to a two-story tall garage. Inside, he fills up a six-foot-wide balloon with hydrogen gas.
You wouldn't be able to use your equipment while I would be inflating. We would have to do this interview outside in the wind because of the risk of static electricity that would create a potential explosion hazard. But we're under no threat right now because it's contained safely within that latex.
Helium is safer, but it's too pricey to ship way out to the middle of the Bering Sea, so they generate their own hydrogen right here. Once the big latex balloon is inflated, Wells takes a string and he ties a small gadget known as a radio sonde to the balloon.
It tracks the temperature, relative humidity, and wind speed and wind direction as it goes up through the atmosphere, and it's supposed to give us a relative atmospheric profile.
Wells opens up the double-tall garage door. Then he grabs the balloon string in one hand and checks his watch with the other. When the clock strikes three, he sprints out the gate and makes a mad dash across the tundra toward a gravel road. As the balloon clears the high garage door, a 30-knot wind whips it to the east. The force of the Bering Sea wind pummels the balloon into a shape basically like a 3D comma. Once he reaches the road, he releases the balloon and it shoots away. The gadget dangling beneath it knocks his Carolina Panthers wool cap off his head as it rockets past. The balloon takes off more like an airplane than a balloon in this wind. Wells returns to the garage and closes it up.
Now, I'm going to apologize to you, but I'm going to take off almost in a full-bore sprint.
He does a 100-yard sprint back to his office to make sure the radio sonde is transmitting data. It is. No need for a second launch today. It's a daily routine for Wells. For the balloon, it's a one-time affair. As it rises 20 miles into the sky, it swells up about 7 times its original size. Then it bursts and returns to Earth as debris, most likely somewhere in the Bering Sea. But not before it has sent back valuable data.
We are such a remote location. Our data is pretty precious.
That data gets used within the hour in the 4 p.m. forecast that mariners and others rely on.
Balof Islands near shore waters. Storm warning Thursday. Tonight, south wind 25 knots becoming southeast 35 knots after midnight. Sea 7 feet building to 11 feet after
midnight. Wells says he's always loved the weather, especially the meat and potatoes of gathering raw information to make a forecast.
It just takes a lot of skill and hardiness to do it, and I'm proud to do it.
He might not get to do it forever. The National Weather Service is testing an automatic balloon launching device at its station in Kodiak in November. Someday, the human launchers could be replaced by machines at the 13 weather stations in Alaska and those across the country. For now, Wells is a continent away and then some from his native North Carolina, but he says he doesn't mind.
I feel privileged to be doing this because, you know, I'd always wanted to work for the Weather Service, and now I am working for the Weather Service, and I couldn't be happier.
He says his quiet life on the outskirts of St. Paul, on the outskirts of America, is a little rustic, but it's been good for him.
I lost 25 pounds after I moved up here because I didn't have the temptations of fast food restaurants.
It's a different career path than his classmates who get dressed up and sweep their arms in front of maps on the TV news. Jobs like his make their forecasts possible.
They can have the TV and the radio. I'll stick with this.
Reporting from St. Paul, I'm John Ryan.
A band of Russian performers with their sights set on Sitka are reportedly still in Moscow awaiting visas. One Russian did make it to the Alaska Day festivities over this past weekend. KCAW's Emily Kwong went to the airport to greet him.
Though born in Moscow, Khalid Eisen lives in the United States. He's the deputy consul general of the Russian consulate in Seattle. and was greeted by a small party at the Rocky Gutierrez Airport in Sitka.
Welcome to Sitka.
Thank you so much.
One thing that's striking about Eisen, he's an impeccably dressed man, with white hair neatly trimmed and a tidy suitcase for the weekend. When asked why he wanted to come to Sitka, he said it's always been high on his travel list, particularly on Alaska Day.
I'm a curious man, still curious man, and I would like to see with my own eyes what's going on and what happened here more than a century ago.
Zlata Lund came down from Anchorage to serve as a translator. Her mother, Natalia, joined her, presenting Eisen a stack of blinis, thin pancakes on a silver platter. Though Zlata had mentally prepared for a whole cohort of Russians, she wasn't disappointed that it was only one.
One is better than none, and it's supposed to start somewhere. This is the beginning, and 2017 is coming. Hopefully, in that year, we'll speak history, we will talk history, we will commemorate history, we will learn history.
Hal Spackman, the director of the Sitka Historical Society, anticipates there will be a wave of Russian interest in Sitka these next 2 years. He considers the 150th anniversary of the transfer a ripe chance for tourism, bringing money and pride.
I had my grandchildren here, and they were beaming to be able to welcome that person, you know, and that'll be a memory for the rest of their life.
One of his grandchildren, Tanner Steinson, bestowed Eisen a wooden platter shaped like a fish. He shyly said the gift was on behalf of the children of Alaska. Eisen beamed and tucked it under his arm. I asked Eisen what he thought about burgeoning hostility between our two countries in Syrian airspace. Eisen said that was a question he should leave up to what he called the big bosses. He added that these developments don't affect his job much, and he's doing what he can to improve relations from his side of the Bering Strait.
This June, the legislature of the state of Washington proclaimed month of June as a month of Russian-American historical heritage.
Eisen considers this a huge victory for the consulate, and he's pleased to see that Sitka has long embraced this history.
Especially during this Alaska Day on the 18th of October. Of course, this day belongs to the history of our two countries, Russia and the United States.
And with that, the Deputy Consul General was whisked away to his next stop, the Fortress of the Bear. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., John Ryan in Unalaska, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.